The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. Musician Avadhajan Pratt had a very busy childhood. He started learning piano at age 6, violin at age 9, and he was also a very serious tennis player as a teenager. And when the time came to choose which path to take, music won. Avadhajan Pratt attended Peabody Conservatory of Music as both a piano and violin student and also earned a graduate diploma in conducting. In 1992, he won the Naumburg International Piano Competition, launching a far-reaching performing career and eventually a career as an assistant professor of piano at the University of Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music. Avadhajan Pratt joined me to discuss his remarkable career as a musician. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Now, you had very early lessons in music, as I just said. Were either of your parents musicians at all?
Not really. My father played the organ when he was a kid, but he loved classical music, and so that was the music that was in the home all the time.
Mm-hmm. And you have a sibling who also was
I have a sister who also played both piano and violin for a long time.
So this was clearly very intentional and very serious on your parents' part to get you both involved in this?
I believe that I expressed an interest in music and in conducting when I was young, and I think, you know, Leonard Bernstein was on television or something, and, you know, it was the only music in the home, so, you know, I liked it. And so I don't think my parents had any grand plan. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I can't speak to my sister's motivations. It might have just been that her older brother was doing it and she wanted to do it too. But I don't know.
You know, that's really interesting. You've sort of touched on something that puts a light bulb on over my head, because I also grew up in a household with parents who were music lovers but not musicians.
Okay.
And so I got, you know, signed up for ballet lessons when I was very, very little. I started playing the flute at 8, and I'm sort of curious to know, because we also pretty much only had classical music in the house, and I was almost isolated from the world of kind of any other music for a very long time, unlike my peers. So I'm curious, was that the experience you had as well?
Yes, I knew very little. So my mother would, you know, we had some blues LPs or something that she would play from time to time, but nothing to, not that much of it, not that often. Right. And then it was when I went to college at at University of Illinois, I started, and that's when I started to hear other kinds of music. So I listened to pop music a lot in the 80s. So that's when I went to school at 82, in 82. And it was about that, it held my interest for about that long. You know, so after, there are a few people that I came to appreciate, Prince and Sting and a few couple others as kind of dimensional artists and musicians. But what also happened was that I had friends who were – there was a big jazz program at Illinois, and so I had friends that were in all the bands and played in the jazz club and stuff like that. So I grew to have a deep and continuing love of jazz.
Do you play any jazz?
I don't. At that time, you know, I knew a couple of the – well, very fine jazz pianists, who turned out to be. And I had always thought that I would learn jazz. And then, I mean, I was busy doing these other things, and it's a completely different language. So it was a long time, you know, where I said it would take me half as long as I've been playing the piano again to learn, you know, to be fluent in this other language. So.
Yeah, yeah. When we get this very squared off 90-degree angle kind of training as a classical musician, it really is different to look at music differently.
Language,
So what was your experience like as a young music student? You know, early experience, did you really just take to the piano so easily that you knew music was your thing? And I'm curious to know also what prompted you to start playing violin a few years later?
Well, I don't think there was nothing prodigious about what I was doing. I think we just stayed with it. Violin started in the public schools in fourth grade, and sort of strings did at the time. Huh. And I kind of decided I wanted to do that also. Hmm. So, but you know, as you mentioned, tennis was a big part of our life. My dad was our coach, there was a lot more, many more hours, particularly in the summer, devoted to tennis and travel and all that sort of thing. So when I was 15, I started college at 16, and I had to decide what I was going to do, what I was going to study. And my parents suggested that I think about what I, you know, the decision would sort of be what are you doing for the rest of your life in many ways. And I felt that if I didn't do any of the other things I was interested in during the course of a day, whatever, I did some writing and this and that and the other, that I would be totally fine if I didn't hit a tennis ball. But if I wasn't engaged with music, I wouldn't be okay. So that's what was the decision maker for me.
Wow. Wow. Have you ever questioned that?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Incredibly rich life, the musical life, and dealing with composers in the past and the way that we do. There's no. It's infinite, you know. Yeah. It provides infinite interest and pleasure.
Yeah. So. Now, you started your college training at 16, is that right?
Yeah.
So that's, you know, on the one hand, you're pretty young freshman.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you were also highly accomplished, despite being younger than probably most of your peers. What was that like? Was there any dissonance with that?
I was not. I mean, as I say, there was, you know, I played a concert, I think, when I was 14 or 15 or something with my sister. We accompanied each other and played some tenor music and some solo stuff. But there was really no big – I was not prodigious. And I started at Illinois. In fact, I didn't want to stop playing either instrument, but it worked out. Illinois didn't allow double majors. And my violin teacher at in high school, was friendly with the violin teacher at Illinois. I didn't go far from home because I was 16. It was 45 minutes away. And so I started at Illinois as a violin major. And I had and that teacher, it was Catherine Tate, taught at a place called Meadowmount in upstate New York. Big school for strings. She'd gone to Curtis and Juilliard. And so she had a studio full of people from all over the world. I grew up in this small town in Normal, Illinois, and everybody was from Bloomington Normal, you know. And if there were, occasionally go to a regional competition or something like that, and there's some kids from Chicago and whatnot. But, I mean, these students were literally from all over the world, all over the United States, all over the world. And I was, I was the worst freshman. there was nothing auspicious about – I mean, I had a nice scholarship. I can say that. But and then I was taking piano lessons from a teaching assistant, a doctoral student who, from time to time would say, you really could be a piano major too. There was no opportunity. Eventually, though, the school hired a Brazilian viola teacher, and violin and viola, and his wife was a pianist, and they were sort of hired to teach at the big there was an academy, a music academy, in Champaign, Illinois, and then they were brought on kind of as adjunct faculty, and that woman, Daisy DeLuca Jaffe, agreed to teach me in her studio of piano majors. And so they were only there for a couple of years, but I studied with her. And then my last year at Illinois, I studied with Ian Hobson, who was on the piano faculty last year and a half or so. So, but then I didn't want to be at the University of Illinois. There were amazing faculty at the time in every area. It was kind of a real, say golden age, but I mean there were terrific faculty across, you know, so if I was accompanying somebody, you know, with the clarinet studio, the flute studio was Alexander Murray, was the flute British guy, so every, you know, faculty that I was in touch with is amazing, but the school kind of leaned towards music education, and there wasn't the same level of engagement with music, with most of my peers, passion, I guess, you know, just so there were some. I had a few people, but I didn't know what was out there, but I knew there was more out there, and I wanted to. I didn't want to spend time getting a liberal arts education, so I applied to. You know, and by then, yeah, I mean, I still wanted to be a double major, so I applied to Peabody, to New England Conservatory, and to Cleveland. And Cleveland accepted me as a pianist, not a violinist. New England took me as a violinist, not as a pianist, and Peabody took me as both. So I think there would have been a nice situation in Cleveland. They were trying to get some conducting and stuff going, but I really also wanted, I felt like I wanted to be on the East Coast, so mm-hmm. I went to Peabody.
Mm-hmm. And certainly no slouch of a school.
yeah, Peabody was a great school. Yeah.
And when you went to Peabody, you also got a graduate diploma in conducting. So what's that all about? What got you interested in conducting, too?
Well, I started taking conducting courses when I was at Illinois, and that had been my original kind of passion. So I did the courses at Illinois, which were, I don't know the best way to characterize those, but I got to Peabody and I met with the conducting, you know, there was none of the schools and probably still now have undergraduate conducting programs. There are, it's always graduate programs. But I met with the conducting professor, Frederick Prausnitz, and he agreed that I could be a minor. I think it was a conducting minor I was getting a certificate in piano and violin. So for the second and third years of that, I was a conducting minor. And then when I went into the artist diploma program in piano, he accepted me into the graduate performance diploma program for conducting. So I was doing the last 3 years there, I was doing those things.
Wow. Yeah. You have trouble picking what you want to do. You have so many broad interests and passions. It's great. It's great.
It's been lively.
And one of your recordings is Live from South Africa, and that was recorded in Cape Town. Would you talk a little bit about how that project came about and what it was like to make that CD?
Yeah, well, it was very, very interesting. It was, the idea came from, I think it was from my record producer, but probably together with the record company, which was EMI, which, you know, was at a time when that was a thing.
Right.
and it was just after apartheid had ended. And so, I mean, I think the record company was looking at it, you know, probably exclusively as a marketing thing. And I think my producer wanted to do a live album. So, you know, it was organized. It was interesting to be there. I mean, it's a. I've been several times since. I think it remains a complicated place and a place that has not. I mean, it was impossible in many ways for it to live up to its potential, but I don't think it has. Mm-hmm. You know, I met. It was interestingly, the first day I arrived, I was jet lagged. I was asleep at I don't know what hour of the afternoon or morning, what time the call came. And it was from a guy at the U.S. consulate. And he said that he belonged to this church that where Desmond Tutu, I forget the name of the service, was a ecumenical service or something like this. I can't remember. But that he did a service, you know, at 7 a.m., you know, and it was small and I could, you know, meet him. And I was so out of it that I said, let me... Because it was 7 a.m. the next morning, something. I said, let me get back to you. I just got here. I'm not sure. And then I fell back asleep and I woke up. I'm like, wait a minute. This guy just offered me the chance to meet Desmond Tutu. And I said, I'm not sure. You know, so I called him back immediately and said, yes, I want to do this. And so I sat, you know, went to the service and sat next to, it was a small breakfast kind of thing after the service. And I sat next to... the Archbishop, and it was right as they were beginning the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Like, it hadn't yet commenced, hadn't yet started. They were still working out the framework for it and such. But, you know, I think that was an important thing to try and keep peace. And I think Nelson Mandela was the right president to keep peace. But that wasn't the only thing that the country, you know, really needed. And so I'm ambivalent about, you know, it was a cool experience to play it, but it was complicated also because there were Black South Africans that I met. The theater where I played still had the name of, it was called the Nico Theater, which was one of the founding families of apartheid. And so there were people that Black South Africans who didn't want to come to the concert because they didn't want to go into that theater. They hadn't been allowed to go into it previously, and then they didn't want to go while it still had that name. And it was very complicated. The Black South Africans also felt like Black Americans had abandoned them, had not supported them. And I was just kind of like, we vastly overestimate the currency that, you know, I mean, we had a president who... You know, Reagan was the constructive engagement, all this stuff. So it was like it was a very complicated, you know, trip. But musically and playing, it was a solo recital, so all that went nicely.
What did you play on that program?
I don't remember exactly. I know there was let's see, you can probably piece it together. There was a Franck Prelude, Fugue, and Variation. There was some Bach. I think at the time I was kind of doing these, what I call them lasagnas, layering of pieces. Bach and Bach Busoni and certain Rachmaninoff plays, like sort of making an arrangement of pieces with layers, like returning composers throughout. So I can't remember. I think there was a Brahms 117 on that album, some Rachmaninoff. It was a little while ago.
So that was you know, going to post-apartheid South Africa was, you know, something of a moment then.
Yeah.
And right now in this country, diversity and inclusion are also of a moment. This is something that is very much on the minds of, well, you know, whatever, performers and not just music, but, you know, really in all disciplines. So do you have any thoughts about that? That, you know, what are we doing right? What are we doing wrong? What do we need to be doing?
I guess I invited this discussion. But, I mean, it's, again, complicated and goes through many layers of – I think the biggest issue is contact and – you know, it's to the forefront now in another arena completely, like the NFL hirings of coaches. And there's a procedure that's designed to create diversity, the Rooney Rule, and people honor the procedure but don't you know, the number of minority coaches has declined even as they're having – the ones that are there have great success, you know. And so it's – but the owners and general managers, I mean, essentially, just say they don't know Black people. You know, they don't know Hispanic people. And so they're more comfortable with the people that they've grown up around and live around. And so the you know, it starts with housing and schools and all that kind of thing. So it's, I mean, it's I think that, you know, in classical music, there have been strides made. There's been a, you know, for the duration of my career, starting in '92, There have been diversity efforts, but I, you know, I used to, you know, be invited, you know, an orchestra would host me or an organization and ask me to do an outreach. I'd go to the outreach, I'd go to the school and talk and play and engage with the kids. And then a student would ask, you know, always there'd be a representative from the organization there and would ask the person for, you know, how do I get tickets? And then they're told to call the box office, you know, and I'm kind of like, so after a while I was like, okay, this, you know, somebody needs to be there with tickets. They need to say, you know, have a card, call me directly, right. You know, because the it's just kind of meaningless, you know, and then it's always better to do, you know, when there's, you know, so I'm going in playing the piano and, you know, a lot of schools don't have pianos, right? I mean, so it's, mm-hmm. you know, I've had a few successes where there's a piano somewhere that's been brought in by the local dealer and then it finds a way to stay at the school, right? Mm-hmm. But those things are always better when there's a real active engagement of the orchestra with that school on a regular basis, because otherwise it's like, you know, you're putting a lollipop in a kid's mouth and taking it out, right? There's, I mean, it's just, you know, and so there's it's gotten better in terms of, you know, meaningful and sustained efforts at, but it all starts from the youngest ages, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of real impact, both directions.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. So you're a teacher now, a mentor to a lot of young aspiring musicians. What kind of advice do you give them about their paths to a career? How do you help them sort through all of these passions and things and make good choices for themselves?
It has gotten, you know, I mean, I've been here now for 15 years, this is year 16, I think, and it has changed. I think it's gotten, it's changed, you know, back when I started, it was still possible, I think, in the first few years, if somebody won the right thing to kind of have a kind of breakthrough. But, I mean, the moment that the whole system broke down with record companies, all that stuff, which is – that just changed the landscape. Everything changed at a certain point. And the whole social media possibilities of people starting a career essentially through social media is something that didn't exist and is wonderful and opens – up even more possibilities for people. But people have to, I think students have to know, you know, be really clear about their goals, about who they are, what kind of musician they are, what their values are as a person, mm-hmm. To have a point of view, to have a perspective, to have a statement that remains continuous, consistent, and believable when they're doing these things, right? Mm-hmm. Then there's so many things that can catch someone's eye, and I guess the word authenticity maybe is something that falls into play. But it is harder to, you know, people can win a bazillion competitions and it doesn't do anything. You play those mm-hmm. concerts and they're not anymore. And it's not because you're not good or not because you weren't nice to people. They're just, there are no more. And so I mean, I certainly encourage them to learn how to speak. You know, I don't think you can't do anything now without being able to speak to audiences, being able to speak to board members, be able to speak about what you do with mm-hmm. people. And I think that's, and there are some competitions now that are requiring different forms. You know, say if you submit a concert program, mm-hmm. you know, there's one currently of a student in who has to write 1 to 3 paragraphs about why he chose that program, right? Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about that program and what would draw somebody to listen to that program. So that's, you know, that's interesting and relevant and good. But I mean, the other part of it is, I mean, students, also, I mean, it's a conservatory, and there are a lot of conservatories, but not everybody that's a conservatory knows why they're there. You know what I mean? There are people that are just, you know, okay, I've been doing this for a while. It seems like it's kind of the thing I'm best at.
Yeah.
You know, let me do this. Or their families want it some cases. Or so you just have to, you know, if I see certain kind of potentials in students, I encourage that. I also have learned to not, I mean, if I see it and I encourage it, but they are not passionate about it, you know, I can't want it more for them than they want it for themselves, right?
Right.
It's just frustrating
to
do that exercise. So, you know, it's, you know, just respond to what the students are, you know, try and make them see what kind of things are out there and what the possibilities are, and in a realistic way. And then, you know, they have to, you know, they have to be the engine.
Right.
You know, so
they have to have that moment that you had where you said, like, your parents kind of put you on the spot and said, you know, what is the thing that you could live without versus the thing you couldn't live without?
Right.
And
right.
that you had that clarity, that
right.
moment where you understood that, yes, tennis is important to me, but music is really in my heart and soul.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting. I met a young musician recently with a local orchestra who he had won the first prize of a concerto competition. This is actually Blash Montgomery Symphony.
Okay.
So it's Michael Shortok's group.
Mm-hmm.
And this young man is a phenomenal violin player. And again, he was the first prize winner and really, you know, like, just had everything, the chops, the musicality, got up there, the poise, got up there, just, choof, you know, like knocked it off.
Yeah.
And I was interviewing him from the stage. And actually, because I was going to be interviewing him from the stage, I interviewed him ahead of time just to kind of cover some topics so I wouldn't surprise him. And I said, you know, wow, you know, first prize. And he's very actively engaged in international competitions and, you know, really, you know, very seriously studying and seriously competing. And I said, so, you know, do you think you'll go into music? He said, oh, no. Very confidently, very dismissively, no.
Yeah.
I said, really? And he said, well, you know, I think medicine. I'm interested in being a surgeon. I said, wow, interesting. You know, obviously very academically advanced
yes,
kid.
Right.
And I said, so I'm just curious because, you know, you put so much effort and, you know, money, time, energy, intent into this musical activity that you're doing. You know, this is not convenient,
right,
what you're doing.
Right.
And so I'm sort of curious to know if you are so clear that you don't want to pursue this as a career, like what is kind of what's in it for you? You know, I don't think I said it quite that way, but and he kind of looked at me. He said, well, you know, a lot of my friends are very involved in sports at very high level where they're, you know, they compete and they train and they have practice and they have, you know, all these meets out of town and et cetera, et cetera. And he said, none of them are going to be professional athletes.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, yes, the light bulb went on over my head. And I thought, you know, there is certainly intrinsic value in musical study and musical exposure. And who, you know, as a musician myself, I thought, well, I should have thought of that. But this was such a wise 16-year-old kid to sort of understand that the intrinsic value of simply being passionate about music and fulfilling whatever kind of interests you have in music, it's not a bad thing, even if you don't intend to go into it as
a
profession.
That's
so,
It's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think to an extent we're, you know, I mean, I don't know what your background was, but I mean, when you see somebody who has it, you know, I didn't have it all together in all those ways when I was a high school student, right? So you see somebody who's got one, they've won national, but it's like, go do it. You got it. You know,
I know.
You're ready. You know,
I know. And then, and for him to just say, like no.
Yeah.
And he was very clear.
Thing. Yeah,
you know, it was not like, well, you know, I'm not really sure. It was, no.
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
That's interesting.
So, yeah.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of.
Yeah. But I really admired him because clearly he had some wisdom about this.
Right,
you know?
And given it some thought.
For a 16-year-old kid, a lot more wisdom than I had at 16.
Yeah, for sure, me too.
So you have a lot of interests and talents, not only the violin, the piano, conducting, tennis. I understand you're also quite an avid chess player and a wine connoisseur. You have a family. You have a career as a conservatory professor. I'm curious to know how you found that balance in your life and if you have any pearls of wisdom for other people, you know, in any discipline to find that satisfying balance as you have.
I don't know that I have any balance. I mean, I feel like I'm, I try to, you know, I've got all these things that I do and that I'm interested in, and I try to honor them all. And, you know, make some difficult choices here and there. But I don't, I certainly, you know, I think I'm managing fine, but I certainly don't have any answers or wisdom to share. Okay. I think we all have got our, you know, different, you know, every, you know, it's like, or when I won Naumburg and I started playing all these concerts and, you go from playing two concerts or three student recitals in a year or something to playing 30, 40, 50 concerts. And I thought, my goodness, I wish that, you know, one of my teachers had said something, you know, so not all, the only one who'd probably experienced something like that was probably Fleischer, right? He played, you know, had a full-on career as a pianist, performing pianist. I'm like, but I mean, there were other people that, you know, that were close enough to it, you know, and I'm like, why didn't anybody say, you know, this or that or the other? And then the further that I got into it, I realized that everybody, I mean, there would be nothing for them to tell me, you know, they'd say, okay, you need to be consistent. It's probably the biggest piece of advice or something, but everybody's situation is different. You know, everybody's how someone adjusts to travel, how people adjust to different instruments. Everything is different for everybody. So it's funny because as many things are the same about sort of the general human condition, like how we respond to things is different, and the advice would have to be different.
Sure.
You know, would be have to be tailored to the person.
Sure. So, sure. Okay. So, no, fair enough. I kind of hit you with that one.
Yeah.
So tell me, what kind of projects do you have coming up? Do you have a wish list? Do you have any more CDs on the horizon,
please?
What
was the first thing? Do I have a what?
Do you have a wish list of things, some projects coming up?
So there's a big project coming up that I'm in partnership with Mark Rabideau, who's at 21CM at DePauw University.
Mm-hmm.
Who's an old, was my classmate at University of Illinois.
Oh.
We raised a lot of havoc on the campus there together. And I've commissioned seven composers.
Oh.
Who are Tyshawn Sorey, Jesse Montgomery, Judd Greenstein, Paula Pristini, Alvin Singleton, Pateras Vasks, and Jonathan Bailey Holland. Jonathan was the composer in residence here at the CSO for the last couple of years, to write for various combinations of. So Vasks is transcribing a piece that he wrote for violin and cello. I'm super happy to. I mean, I've loved his music for a long time. Really powerful composer.
Mm-hmm.
He's transcribing a piece for violin and cello. Tyshawn Sorey is writing a piece. So the other collaborators on the project, as far as the recording goes, and not necessarily all the performances, but Roomful of Teeth is a collaborator. And for recording, it's with a Far Cry out of Boston.
Nice.
And so Tyshawn is writing for me and Roomful of Teeth. Paula is writing for all three. I think Jesse's writing for just a string orchestra, piano and string orchestra. Jonathan's writing for all three. Judd is writing for all three. Who am I forgetting? It's always I get to six and I'm like seven. I can't remember. But anyway, so this is a – so the first scores start coming in April.
Mm-hmm.
I think April and June. And then the last one comes in January of 2022.
Mm-hmm.
So we're planning – working on performances and then a recording probably in the early, late spring, early summer of 2022.
Hmm.
The cool thing about it is that it's all, everybody is writing about, or in reference to, or in taking inspiration from T.S. Eliot, The Four Quartets, from Bernd Norton, the stanza at the still point of the turning world, neither flesh nor fleshless, that whole stanza is five lines. At the still point of the turning world, there the dance is. So that's the common the inspiration source for all the composers. So, so that's exciting. It's been, you know, in the works for a couple of years now, I guess. So that's the big thing. Doing a little bit more conducting. I've got the Chamber Orchestra of Pittsburgh at the end of May, doing a Coriolan Overture, First Concerto from the Keyboard, and Beethoven Eighth Symphony, all Beethoven program. Possibly something in Republic of Georgia, which would be the same program in late, or actually would precede that, but still end of May. The opening concert for Art of the Piano this year, we're doing in collaboration with the Cincinnati Chamber Orchestra. And so I'll be conducting that with playing the First Concerto again, Olga Kern playing the Emperor Concerto. And then we'll have a student, one of our alums and probably also a student at the festival, a young artist playing First Movement of Beethoven Fourth Concerto. So that'll be exciting. And then the furthest afield thing is conducting Porgy and Bess in November with the Greensboro Opera. I've never conducted an opera before, so I'm excited about that. And came back, the director there actually came here with me. We went to the last night of the production here this summer. And then also went to check out the production of the Met earlier this fall. So that's those are the new and interesting fun things coming up.
Wow.
A lot of stuff.
Well, Dr. Pratt, I cannot tell you what a pleasure it is to finally meet you in person and finally get a chance to chat about this remarkable life you have, this remarkable career. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.